Welcome to the Legally Sound Smart Business Show, your weekly look at legal news and questions in the business world. Here are your hosts, Nasser Pasha and Matt Staub.
All right, welcome to Legally Sound Smart Business. This is Nasser Pasha.
And this is Matt Staub.
And this is where we go over some of the business news with our legal twist and also answer some of your business legal questions. But today, we have a guest in studio. Matt, why don't you introduce Tyler so that way it'd be nice and official.
Okay. We have Tyler Sickmeyer with Fidelitas Development, correct?
Yes, sir. Thank you for remembering my company's name. I know you had trouble with the CPA last week, so I feel like I've moved up in the world.
Well, it's still hard to pronounce. You know, you guys all have made up words, and our last CPA had about 10 words in their firm name, so we got it right, I think, this time.
Can I just say before we get started that I agree with what had to be resounding feedback from your listener base that there is absolute demand for Matt to sing Miley Cyrus on the podcast.
Wow. So that was my first question is, are you a listener? And obviously you are. You've listened to one episode at least.
I don't know what to say about that.
All right. Well, very good. Well, let's get started. Matt, what do we have first up today?
So the first article this week, another Yelp article, but a little bit different than the one we went over last episode. This one deals with the Yelp reviews that businesses get, particularly the negative ones. And there's a bunch of stories in here, but the ones that really strike me the most are the companies that advertise with Yelp or maybe get calls from Yelp saying they should advertise. At some point, they either drop the advertisements or they don't end up doing it. And then these negative reviews pop up. Some of these businesses seem to think that these aren't real people that are leaving the reviews. And it raises a whole issue of, are these legitimate people that are leaving the reviews? There doesn't seem to be that good of a verification process. It's just hard to track in general.
Yeah, there seems to be some kind of underground thought amongst most business owners that if you don't advertise with them, then you're going to get hit somehow. Either your positive reviews are going to be hidden or vice versa, your negative reviews are going to be popped up. Now, we're three of us here. Tyler's in marketing. Have you got any calls from your clients or other business owners that have faced this issue?
Absolutely. We've dealt with Yelp in multiple markets, and our advice to clients has always been that it's a necessary evil. We're not necessarily fans of Yelp, and I tell our clients we use part of the monthly ad budget to basically pay off the Yelp mafia, so to speak. I tell them, I said, it's not about the ROI that you get as far as the number of click-throughs to your website. And they do send you, as an advertiser, weekly updates with how many click-throughs you get, impressions, et cetera, et cetera. And it's frankly quite paltry for most businesses. And I've got 10 or more clients that I get these Yelp updates weekly for. And all of them are fairly consistent. They're getting somewhere around 100 or so impressions, give or take, depending on market size. And it doesn't seem to have much of an impact at all on their business, especially for what their cost is, which I don't want to go into too many details there just because of confidentiality for what we do with our clients.
Sure.
The ROI is not there at all. What we tell our clients, though, is it's still necessary because of the negative review factor that tends to happen otherwise.
Yeah, well, it's so prevalent, right? Yelp is just pretty much what everyone uses, especially if you're a restaurant. But the same way goes, if you have a few bad reviews, it can kill your business. And that's the problem too, right? Because Yelp's actually been sued quite a number of times. And the prevalent lawsuit that this article references is the plaintiffs in that case were not able to prove their allegations that Yelp was somehow interfering with their algorithm based upon whether you advertise or not. And of course, I'm sure a lot of our listeners are wondering if that's true or not, because I think from a personal anecdotal experience, that's not the case.
Yeah. And looking at one of the more recent cases that looks like it's been appealed, that they weren't even giving all the information in the discovery process. They're saying it was protected, it looks like. You just don't know what they're doing. It's very difficult for any business, especially one that's getting these negative reviews and doesn't understand why.
Well, they hide behind the Communications Decency Act, and that's what is used to also protect them from defamation claims. We get calls all the time of business owners having reviews that they feel that are either made up or made by their competition. And the question is Yelp responsible or the reviewer responsible? And that act actually gives them some kind of shield for that.
The other thing businesses have to remember too is that you can gripe about it all you want, but unfortunately, Yelp is a part of the world that we live in and the rules that we play this game by now. So really, they can do one of two things. They can either choose to ignore something that's critical, because I don't know if you guys were aware of this, but Yelp actually factors in to algorithm rankings on Siri and Iris on Apple and Android phones.
Really? Wow.
So if you ask Siri to find you a pizza joint, since I know everyone on this podcast loves pizza, preferably one with,
oh my gosh,
preferably one with great sauce. So if I ask,
okay, I'll take that.
So if I ask Siri to find me a pizza joint, Yelp is a big factor of what comes up and the review factors in. So really, as a business, you can choose to ignore it or gripe or whatever, but that doesn't solve your problem. And really what you need to do is be proactive. If Yelp calls you, you need to figure out some way to incorporate them into your ad budget if you can afford it at all. And then number two, you need to counteract any negative reviews that you would get anyways with positive reviews. And by doing that, you need to set up a referral campaign,
yeah,
and ask your loyal customers that love your product anyways to write reviews about how great your pizza sauce is or whatever it is that brought you into the door. Maybe Matt would even write a review about crust.
No, I think that's a good point.
And he actually does listen to these episodes. Wow, that's really, I'm impressed.
I like to be prepared.
Yeah. He probably read the Cliff Notes or something, but let's get on to our next question.
So let's see. This one comes from a marketing firm in San Francisco, which may be Tyler's firm disguised. Who knows? We'll see the question. We are trying to close a deal before the end of the month, so can I make my employees work on Thanksgiving?
Everyone's talking about all the retailers making their employees work on Thanksgiving. So obviously it's not against the law, but the question is, under what circumstances can you do that? Are they owed overtime or premium pay, as some employees call it?
In California, I think it's just kind of tough luck. If your employer wants you to come in on Thanksgiving, you're going to have to come in, and you're not going to get overtime for it either. And they can also allow you to... They can also give you the day off and not pay you for it. I mean, depending on how you're classified. But I think the main thing here, and this is all California, of course, but I think the main thing here is just have a own policy with your company. And if you want to give those days off, you can give them. Obviously, some companies, for maybe the restaurant industry, for example, or a gas station, they have to have people working still on Thanksgiving. And that's something you're going to have to do. But I think it's making your employees happy by giving them Thanksgiving off. If they don't really have to be there, you're probably going to lose some workers if you're forcing them to be there on the holidays.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And in California, there's no requirement for any kind of holiday pay at all. But if you put in your employment manual, for example, that certain days are a holiday, then you actually have to follow that employment manual. So you want to make sure that when you do form that, that's contemplated as well.
Also, something else to consider is whether or not you want your employees to hate you and start looking for employment elsewhere.
That's true.
Believe it or not, that was not my question, disguised as a marketing firm from San Francisco. But I'll be happy to take some of their talent when they want to leave. And if any of their employees are listening, we're actually giving our team all of Wednesday and part of Tuesday off in addition to the four-day weekend. So
sign me up for that.
Culture is king.
Culture is king. We talked about that in one of the previous episodes as well.
No doubt. If you have happy employees, when they get terminated, you know, and every once in a while you're going to have turnover, they're going to be appreciative of the time that they spent with you. And if they're not, they're going to find a reason to get back at you with a lawsuit.
And to tie it into your first question, they're less likely to leave a negative Yelp review.
There we go.
Oh, you know, that's a great point, because I don't know how many times ripoffreport.com is a common one too. And I've dealt with clients when, after we've terminated an employee, they've basically went off and ripoff report and said some truths and some non-truths as well. And so that's definitely a good point.
All right. We'll get in here to the next article. The main company in this article is Airbnb, but it gets into a bigger topic. But I don't know if how familiar you are with Airbnb. It's a way for people to do, you know, maybe a one-night rental at someone's house or part of their where they live, just to make a few extra bucks if rent is tight.
Have either of you participated in Airbnb?
I have not, Tyler.
I have not either. I actually looked at it.
Really?
When I came out to San Diego to visit before I moved out here, I was curious. So I looked into the website, but again, the thought of, I guess, the unknown of staying at someone's house for the same money of staying in a hotel was enough to persuade me that the Holiday Inn was still my recommended place of lodging, which if the Holiday Inn's listening and wants to give me an endorsement deal for that, more than happy to work something out.
Well, it's kind of like a timeshare a little bit in the sense that I used it with my family, went up to Lake Arrowhead, and it was a nice, good size home for about three or four families. And we had a great time. I don't remember what the cost was, but it was similar to what a hotel would have been per person. So, you know, I think it's pretty cool, but they're a new company kind of entering into a relatively new company, entering into a field that are usually exclusively owned by hotels. And I think that's the issue here, especially in New York with hotel regulation.
Right. And that's what this is about, is the Attorney General in New York's cracking down on, I think it only was about 7% of the people that are renting out their places, but still a lot. But it gets to a bigger point of, you have all these private homeowners. They are technically competing with hotels, and these private homeowners aren't going to be taxed the same. What about zoning issues?
Safety regulations.
Yeah, safety regulations, tenant protection laws. It is a big difference. So it's not just, this isn't a petty thing trying to go after people trying to, you know, make their mortgage payment. This is actually a pretty big legal issue.
And I think the article talks about just the whole sharing economy of these new startups as well, and how that relates to the law, that these businesses are just going too fast for the law to keep up.
Right. And it does mention, and I think we talked about this on a previous episode, but Uber and Lyft and other transportation companies like that. And you're exactly right. It's companies that are outpacing the laws in place. And sooner or later, once some decisions get handed down, I guess we're going to find out what's really going to happen to these. But what's your take on how the legitimacy of what Airbnb is doing?
I think it's a pretty cool website. You know, like I said, I've used it before, and if they can succeed, I think the major issue why people are really focusing on this is protecting tenants, that is the guests themselves, and also taxes. But I think the taxes issue is probably the biggest deal for the Attorney General and state regulators. Let's get on to our next question. And by the way, you can send in your question, like Tyler did just earlier from a marketing firm in San Francisco, to ask@legallysoundsmartbusiness.com. And you can also go to the website. We also have a form there too. I know people have used that as well to submit your questions.
Second question. This is a long one, so give me a minute here.
1 minute.
A customer recently tried to pay with a credit card, but it would not scan. We checked his ID and entered the number manually, and the payment went through after that. Later, we got a call saying the transaction was being investigated for fraud. We're kind of stuck here. What can we do about getting the money and or the products we sold back? And that's from a business in Orange County.
Well, it's basically asking the same question. If someone came and stole something out of my store, what do I do to get it back? Because that's pretty much what happened there. And unfortunately, and I'm making some assumptions here, this business owner's agreement with the credit card merchants are pretty consumer friendly. And so the chargeback and the whole system is designed to protect the consumer. And anyone who's made any efforts to fight any chargebacks have understood the frustration that they go through in order to get some of these fees back. And almost always you lose. I would say 1 out of 10 times. And it's a very unfortunate process. And that's why it's up to the merchants to make sure that they're not being scammed. But the problem is here, he looks like he or she checked the ID, right? And enter the number manually.
Yeah, that's what it says. So it did match up, at least at the beginning, but who knows? It could be a whole scheme that this person does at multiple places.
Yeah, that's unfortunate. So that's probably the toughest questions we've had, because I don't know if we have an answer for them.
Yeah, it's tough.
Tough luck.
There's your answer. Tough luck.
Mwah, mwah.
Yeah. Well, like I said, you can send your questions in. We'll try our best to answer them. We won't be successful at any time. But what can we take out of this is I think at least, you know, these merchant contracts are pretty hefty and complicated, but focus on the chargeback process. Some are better than others for the business that is. And I'm sure anyone who's an American Express holder knows that those are notoriously more favorable to consumers as well. And so little things like that can make a difference of whether or not you're going to allow some of your customers to put a big charge that may have a big impact on your business. But at the end, I think this is a cost of doing business. The same thing as you know, someone breaking something in the in your store to having a certain loss of product. And that's kind of how you have to calculate it.
Right. I agree. It is the cost of doing business. We'll get into our break here. I don't know if anyone saw this story that came out earlier this week. I'm sure people have heard of the Samsung and Apple lawsuit that was going on. There was a decision handed down and there was a judgment. I don't know if it later got reduced, but the original judgment was a $1 billion judgment that Samsung was ordered to pay to Apple. And the story that was circulating was that they were paying them in 5-cent pieces. Didn't say nickels, just 5-cent pieces. And this story was circulating on multiple websites. People were promoting this thing. But basically, I think maybe even that day, it turned out that it was fake. And I guess anyone that could think about it, just the sheer amount of nickels that would be just doesn't make sense. That's $1 billion. So
yeah, people started doing the calculations and the weight that it would take.
Yeah, 20 billion nickels. Good luck getting your hands on that. But I think this raises a different issue. And I don't know if I don't think Samsung or Apple was behind this, but I know there's been stories in the past of companies doing fake stories that are ridiculous just to get attention or just to get their name out there. So I thought this would be good for to get Tyler's take on this. Is what do you think of this sort of marketing ploy that some of these companies might do?
I think a lot of it just depends on the context. If you fool the consumer in a positive way, it's okay. But if the consumer is harmed or feels damaged or let down in any way, for example, if you say...
I think they call that fraud, right?
Yes, exactly. If you're fraudulent in your marketing, obviously there's going to be more backlash than anything good. You know, a perfect example of that would be if you say, again, we'll go back to the show's favorite topic. If I'm a restaurant and I say I'm going to give away pizza for a year, right? And then it turns out that that's one pizza a month for half a year. So it's really just six free pizzas. That's going to be kind of a letdown for whoever wins it.
I'm already let down.
Yeah. So that sort of false advertising doesn't work. Other times, I think of a time a consumer was fooled and it worked really well was for, I believe it was Panasonic or Sony's new TV set. And the point they were trying to make in this viral video they shot was that the picture was so real you could mistake it for real life. And I don't know if you guys saw this video or not, but this company was doing fake job interviews somewhere in Argentina or Chile or Brazil, somewhere in South America. And they had mounted a TV that looked like a window in behind the boss. Mm. And then during the course of the interview, the sky changes and a meteor crashes into the cityscape behind them. And so naturally the boss plays along and they freak out and then the lights go out in the office and then the lights come on and the guy or girl, whoever was interviewing is in the room by themselves, obviously panicked.
Sure.
Then they come out and explain to them that, no, you didn't really just witness the end of the world. We just showed you how awesome our TV was.
Wow.
And as harsh as that was to that one individual, that sort of false representation worked really well for them in the online landscape. So it really just depends on the seriousness of the campaign and what you're trying to do. Something like the fake $1 billion coin story, I don't think is bad, but you do have to be careful from a PR standpoint of burning bridges.
Well, we're not sure if this came from Samsung, right?
Yeah, or wherever it came from. Yeah,
I think the sites that were reporting it were pretty small blogs. So my guess, it was blogs just trying to get traffic.
Yeah. Well, what's funny, it's believable because I think people wanted to believe it because I think people are really getting tired of all these big companies suing each other for patents that they've purchased and over the most minute technology. And it just seems counterintuitive. And maybe we'll get to a point where we can talk about patent trolls and that whole industry of the patent wars that go on without most people even having knowledge of. So that's our legal twist on that Samsung-Apple battle.
Actually, quick story. I once made a bet with a friend, $20 over something, and he paid me in pennies after I won. So I guess it's kind of believable. So it's a little bit of a hassle.
And I read the story, the fake story. They said, well, the contract didn't specify what kind of legal tender it could be and so forth. And
right.
And I don't know the details of the law in this case, but I'm pretty sure even if there was a settlement and it didn't specify, Apple would still have the opportunity to reject or accept those coins because even though coins are legal tender, only the federal government has the obligation to accept it as legal tender, not between private parties. Just a little note there.
All right, let's get into the next story here. So this one is about Facebook. And
I've heard of them.
Yeah, Facebook. I'm glad you've heard of them. It's basically talking about what would happen if Facebook disappeared it seems crazy. They have 1 billion users right now, but they cite, you know, MySpace, Sony Walkman, other forms of technology. Obviously, technology is constantly evolving, but what would happen to all these companies that invested a lot of time and a lot of effort or maybe even money into Facebook and got all these people to like their page? And what if it just disappeared? It just, would it be a complete waste of time for these businesses? Or I guess that's kind of what the article is kind of hitting on.
I'd say a couple points. Number one, companies have adapted to social media fairly well. I remember back when I was in college and I was running a concert promotions company at the time, and MySpace had just become popular. This was 2005, 2006. So I realized by that point it was old hat on the West Coast, but bear with me. I'm from the Midwest and we're a little bit slower to get things out there. So as MySpace became bigger, I had actually gotten to the point where I was using it to market my concert promotions company in class. And I had mastered this technique to where I could click the add friend button repeatedly because it had like that list of 40 people at once, you know, if you were searching for something. So I could add 40 people at once to my company's page while making eye contact with my English teacher. So that's a little fun background story. But the point is from manually adding friends on MySpace to the more complex Facebook pages with actual analytics and reporting and narrow targeting of target demographics today, the ad world's going to keep evolving with social media. It has and it will no matter what's thrown out there. You know, you look at just in the last 6 months or so, Twitter ads have started to become more and more popular. And 2 years ago, no one would have figured out how to monetize that platform in the first place. So the key, I think, for businesses is to be agile.
Yeah, that's right.
And just remain nimble regardless of what comes out. And if Facebook did disappear, which isn't going to happen, but if Facebook did disappear, you just chalk it up to, okay, what's next? Because Facebook's not going to go away without something replacing it. And so if Facebook does go away, it's all about how quickly can you adapt to what's next. And if you remain nimble, that actually gives some of your listeners that are smaller businesses an advantage over their larger competitors because they can adapt to the new platforms more quickly.
Yeah, I think that's well said, definitely. I think I have a problem with some businesses that their entire business model is relying on a third party. And I know with some of the tech geeks that are listening, fellow tech geeks, when you have these startup companies that use the API, which is basically the interface between third-party apps and Facebook, for example, then you're basically at the mercy of what Facebook or these other companies like Twitter, classically, they changed their terms of service to shut off some of their features on the API and really shut down certain startups. And so I think it's a reality that Facebook is going to change. It's going to have to be agile itself as well. And this comes down to terms of service. I think this article talks about some of the Facebook pages and how that may affect future business.
And the difference between Facebook and MySpace, you look at MySpace came out at a time when the whole concept of social networking was still really new.
Yeah, it was new.
And they beat out Friendster to kind of become the go-to site. But then once they changed hands and tried to start monetizing everything and allowed so much custom creation that the pages just got ridiculous. Yeah. No one wanted to sit there and look at a bright pink background with blue Times New Roman font.
Very true.
So people started to migrate off the platform and Facebook happened to be in the right place at the right time of offering that exclusivity for early adapters, i.e. college students, who were able to move first. And so now they're there, and they talk about teens not being on Facebook. I don't think that's as big of a deal because the social networking industry has evolved as such to where when something new comes along, someone else buys it up. So you look at Facebook's attempt to buy Snapchat recently, which got turned down. But at the same time, whether it's Facebook or Twitter or whoever else, there's going to be so many sort of social media titans come into existence. And then once they're there, they'll continue to buy up the latest technology when it comes out. I don't see that many new players coming out with anything that's completely groundbreaking and game-changing to the point where something as large as Facebook would dissolve.
Yeah, it's not going to go away overnight either. So maybe something pops up over time. I'm sure something will, but it'll be a slow transition. It's like you're going to wake up one day and Facebook's going to be gone and it's going to be something else that just exists and you have to scramble.
Let's get to our next question. I've heard of some companies taking payments in the form of Bitcoin. What are the legal requirements to get that set up? And this is from an online electronics leasing company in San Marcos, California. not too far. So Bitcoin, you know, I just read an article, Virgin Galactic, I think is Richard Branson's company that's planning to do space exploration. They announced that they're going to be taking Bitcoin for their fare. And so that's pretty interesting.
Yeah, I saw that. I've seen there's a couple universities that are accepting Bitcoin for payment for tuition. There's restaurants out there across the U.S. that are doing it, or businesses, cheapair.com.
Restaurants?
Yeah, it's it's really gaining some traction, and it really brings into question. I mean, there's a lot of questions about this, obviously. It's virtual currency. There's no paper trail. It's just not really regulated right now either. It's just kind of a free-for-all. I remember the first time I heard about Bitcoin, someone explained it to me, and it seemed like a way to sell drugs and get away with. I mean, that seems like it.
And it was.
Yeah, and it was, too, yeah.
They had a Silk Road, which was basically a separate server that was hosted to buy and sell pretty much everything illegal, everything on the black market. And that was shut down, but I think replaced by something else that we probably don't know of. Or at least I don't.
I actually saw an article yesterday. Apparently, there's a Silk Road 2.0 out there somewhere.
Oh, next version.
Yeah. Nice. So as the law adapts, those trying to avert the law will continue to adapt ahead of it. That's usually how it goes.
You make a good point. So the regulatory agencies, everything from the SEC to even the Treasury Board of the United States, is trying to grapple how to handle this virtual currency that has no regulatory market. And so if this person asks what are the legal requirements to get that set up, I don't think there's a clear answer with that, because from the legal perspective in the United States, I don't think that has been set up to really properly grasp it. But to me, it would be the same as, what do you think, Matt? Basically, barter, right?
You're right. There's no way to really answer this, how to legally do it correctly, because like you said, there's so much uncertainty still. It's not regulated. The best thing I could tell someone who was looking to do this is be as cautious as possible. And one would be definitely make sure that you're paying taxes on it, because it's still income, so you still have to pay tax on it. But there's a lot of uncertainty out there if this. It's pretty interesting.
Well, I have a marketing question, and I think this is good for Tyler since he's in marketing. It seems like these people that announce that, oh, we're accepting Bitcoin, is literally not for the purposes of really accessing a market that exchanges in Bitcoin, but just for the publicity of it. Because now you have an article that says Richard Branson's going to accept Bitcoins for their fare.
Yeah, I mean, it's a PR grab, but again, the question is, like anything else, how long is it going to last, and is it really going to be worth the headache? I'm sure there are several companies that have come out and stated, we accept Bitcoin, and they haven't even trained their staff how to accept it, nor has anyone approached them to pay for it. It's not like they're putting signs out in front of their brick-and-mortar pizza shops asking people to pay with Bitcoins in most cases. Honestly, I do see it as an alternative to some of the cash-based businesses that you see where people try to skirt taxes a little bit. I've had several business owners that I know personally debate going to cash only, and I do see Bitcoin as a alternative that might be a little more ironically secure for the consumer as far as being able to get funds back or offer refunds or different things. It might be a little more secure than cash. The one thing that just scares me about Bitcoin in general is, like you said, the lack of regulation and the fact that the value fluctuates so frequently. How on earth do you keep track of your Bitcoin prices in comparison to your US dollar prices?
Oh, yeah. Just look at this week. It's crashed and peaked about 3 or 4 times this week. And anyone can pull up some articles on that, but that's pretty prevalent.
Right. I actually saw something today that Mark Cuban wrote. He'll be a future guest on the podcast when we do the patent troll stuff. But
I think we got him next week, right?
Yeah, I'm working on it.
Actually, maybe a little later. We're still working on it. Okay.
Speaking of false advertising,
but he made a good point today. He said, "I don't want to invest in Bitcoin at all. Once virtual currency becomes a bigger thing, I'd rather invest in their competitors because they're going to do everything Bitcoin did, but in a much better way, much smarter fashion, more effectively." Which I thought was a really good point. That's why he's been really successful, probably.
Sure. Well, tell him I said hi when next time you talk to him, and
yeah,
hopefully it'll be a guest.
Okay, let's get into
it. All right, what's our last article up?
Last article here. Ashley Madison, which it's apparently all three of us are married, a dating site for married cheaters. I, for one, have never heard of this before.
You pulled the article, so.
That was nice of you to do the research on this and set up an account ahead of time.
Yeah. But the Ashley Madison part really doesn't have to do that much with what the meat of the article. It's kind of all about,
yeah, I'm sure.
It's all about fake profiles, and it gets to the legality or illegality of these fake profiles. Now, what Ashley Madison is doing different than Yelp is they're actually saying, and I believe this is even in their terms of service, that, you know, part of what we do is to provide entertainment. So we want to entertain the people that sign up and pay for these services. We're going to make fake profiles, so it's not illegal. This, it's part of the game. This is entertainment. Yelp is not doing that same way, but it's just an interesting spin on what we talked about at the beginning here.
Yeah, I think this is honestly great lawyering on its face, in the sense that when you have a business online and you set up your terms of service, this is something that is hard to contemplate, that, okay, you're going to have fake profiles, and if someone finds out, then you may get sued because you're misrepresenting. But if you represent in your terms and conditions that this may be a possibility or for its entertainment purposes from the beginning, then you're going to be covered. It's just like any kind of disclaimer. If you listen to the end of the show, which I'm sure you will, you'll hear about it, 5 or 6 different disclaimers that we have. And that's what, of course, lawyers will use to protect them from liability. But here's the point, is that think about this conversation that this business owner had to have with their attorney. I don't know how many times they may hire a law firm or an attorney, but if they don't explain to them the entire business process, that they tell them, let's be honest, right? They're going to make fake profiles, especially for females, because it's maybe dominated, well, I'm making assumptions here, but maybe dominated by one gender or the other. And so therefore they're going to have to do this. But if they didn't have that conversation with their attorney that they're going to be creating these fake profiles, then this language may not have been in the terms of service.
What's going to come down here is this is just a FTC crackdown, because they don't like that there's fictitious content out there. They don't like all that fake stuff that's online. So, like I said, this is a little bit different because they're at least trying to be creative with it, just saying, hey, this is what we do, but this is just the tip of the iceberg, I think.
And here's the ironic part. Let's say there was a class action lawsuit. Who on earth is going to join? How are you going to explain to your spouse?
Very good.
We were wrongfully cheated out of money when I was trying to cheat on you discreetly online.
That's
I'm not sure anyone's going to sign up for that one.
Yeah, I wouldn't want to be the named plaintiff in that class action lawsuit.
Wow. Oh, wow. Yeah, that's a great point. But Matt's right. The FTC is going to get involved with this. But at the end, though, I still think the fact that it says it's an entertainment, you know, it reminds me of those 900 number advertisements. Again, not familiar with, but they would always say at the bottom, for entertainment purposes only. And because everyone knew that when you were calling in that it was, you know, it was an actress or whatever, but they didn't say that, right? They weren't clear. In fact, if anything, some may have been fooled that it was a real phone call with a real person, that it was genuinely interested in what they had to say.
Is that why you kept calling back, Nasser?
I know, I was fooled by my first lawsuit. No, that's definitely not true. All right, well, very good. I think that's it.
I think this went really well for our first guest for a full-length podcast here. So I'd like to give him a minute here just to talk about what him and his company do.
Sure. Well, thanks again for having me on, guys. Again, the name's Tyler Sickmeyer. I run a company called Fidelitas Development. We're a full-service marketing firm. Work with a variety of clients across America and now in New Zealand as well. So
cool.
If you need marketing help or want to figure out how to do things a little bit more efficiently, you can check us out at fidelitasdevelopment.com. And Fidelitas is FIDELITAS.
We'll put a link. Don't worry.
All right. Awesome. Just make sure it comes up right on the screen.
Yeah.
This is televised, right? So also, one quick charity plug. By the time that this comes out, there will only be a day or two left. But we're selling T-shirts to raise money for the Illinois tornado victims. Last week, a lot of communities were devastated pretty hard by that. You can buy a shirt for $20 and 100% of the profits goes to the tornado victims via reputable organizations like the Red Cross and Salvation Army.
Very good.
So if you want to get involved with that, you can go to booster.com/rebuild Illinois and you can get involved there.
And we'll also put a link to that, of course.
Yeah, definitely.
Very good. All right. Well, thanks, Tyler, for spending time with us and the listeners as well. This is our, what episode is this, Matt?
Number 6.
Number 6. Wow. 6 episodes. I can't believe We've done six. I think we should just stop here. Six is enough.
So did I get the part to replace Matt? This was an audition, right?
You're hired, yeah.
At least I don't have to sing now.
That was the deal breaker when you didn't sing Miley Cyrus.
All right. Thanks, guys. Have a good week.
This has been the Legally Sound Smart Business Show with your hosts, Nasser Pasha and Matt Staub. The Legally Sound Smart Business Show is your weekly look at legal news and questions in the business world. Legally Sound Smart Business is a podcast that is intended but not promised or guaranteed to be current, complete, or up to date, and should in no way be taken as an indication of future results. No attorney-client relationship is created by listening or submitting questions to the podcast. The podcast does not constitute legal advice, but rather is offered only for general informational and educational purposes. You should not act or rely on any information in the podcast without first seeking the advice of an attorney. The opinions expressed in the podcast reflect the views of those individuals and do not necessarily represent the views of any other individual or business. For more information about the Legally Sound Smart Business Show, visit LegallySoundSmartBusiness.com.